Side 2. Eidoru by William Gibson. Continuing on page 49. 7. The Wet, Warm Life in Allison Shires. "She'll try to kill herself," Lainey said. "Why?" Kathy Torrance sipped espresso. "A Monday afternoon in the cage." "Because she knows. She can feel me watching."
"That's impossible, Lainey."
"She knows."
"You aren't watching her. You're examining the data she generates, like the data all our lives generate. She can't know that."
"She does." The white cup clinking down into its saucer.
"Then how can you know that she does? You're looking at her phone records, what she chooses to watch and when, the music she accesses. How could you possibly know that she's aware of your attention?"
The nodal point, he wanted to say, but didn't.
"I think you're working too hard, Lainey. 5 days off."
"No, I'd rather..."
"I can't afford to let you burn yourself out. I know the signs, Lainey. Recreational leave, full pay, 5 days."
She added a travel bonus. Lainey was sent to Slit Scan's in-house agency and booked into a hollowed-out hilltop above Iztapa, a hotel with vast stone spheres ranged across the polished concrete of its glass-walled lobby. Beyond the glass, iguanas regarded the registration staff with an ancient, calm, green scales bright against dusty brown branches. Lainey met a woman who said she edited lamps for a design house in San Francisco. Tuesday evening. He'd been in Mexico 3 hours. Drinks in the lobby bar. He asked her what that meant, to edit lamps. Lainey had recently noticed that the only people who had titles that clearly described their jobs had jobs he wouldn't have wanted. If people asked him what he did, he said he was a quantitative analyst. He didn't try to explain the nodal points or Kathy Torrance's theories about celebrity. The woman replied that her company produced short-run furniture and accessories, lamps in particular. The actual manufacturing took place at any number of different locations, mainly in Northern California, cottage industry. One maker might contract to do 200 granite bases, another to lacquer and distress 200 steel tubes in a very specific shade of blue. She brought out a notebook and showed him animated sketches. All of the things had a thin, spiky look that made him think of African insects he'd seen on the Nature Channel.
Did she design them?
No.
They were designed in Russia, in Moscow.
She was the editor. She selected the suppliers of components. She oversaw manufacture, transport to San Francisco, assembly in what once had been a cannery. If the design documents specified something that couldn't be provided, she either found a new supplier or negotiated a compromise in material or workmanship. Lainey asked who they sold to. "People who wanted things other people didn't have," she said. "Or that other people didn't like?" "That too," she said.
"Did she enjoy it?"
"Yes. Because she generally liked the things the Russians designed, and she tended to like the people who manufactured the components.
Best of all," she told him,
"she liked the feeling of bringing something new into the world, of watching the sketches from Moscow finally become objects on the floor of the former cannery. It's there one day," she said, "and you can look at it and touch it and know whether or not it's good." Lainey considered this. She seemed very calm. Shadows lengthened with almost visible speed across the floor of glossy concrete. He put his hand over hers. "And touch it and know whether or not it's good." Just before dawn, the editor of lamps, asleep in his bed, he watched the curve of the bay from the suite's balcony, the moon, a milky thing, translucent, nearly gone. In the night, in the Federal District, somewhere east of here, there had been rocket attacks and rumors of chemical agents, the latest act in one of those obscure and ongoing struggles that made up the background of his world. Birds were waking in the trees around him, a sound he knew from Gainesville, from the orphanage, and other mornings there. Kathy Torrance announced herself satisfied with Lainey's recuperation. "He looked rested," she said. He took to the seas of Dat America without comment, suspecting that another leave might prove permanent. She was watching him the way an experienced artisan might watch a valued tool that had shown the first signs of metal fatigue. The nodal point was different now, though he had no language to describe the change.
He sifted the countless fragments that had clustered around Allison Shires in his absence, feeling for the source of his earlier conviction. He called up the music she'd accessed while he'd been in Mexico, playing each song in the order of her selection. He found her choices had grown more life-affirming. She'd moved to a new provider, Upful Group Vine, whose relentlessly positive product was the musical equivalent of the Good News Channel. Cross-indexing her charges against the records of her credit provider and its client retailers, he produced a list of everything she'd purchased in the past week. Six-pack, blades, Tokai carton opener. Did she own a Tokai carton opener? But then he remembered Kathy's advice that this was the part of research most prone to produce serious transference, the point at which the researcher's intimacy with the subject could lead to loss of perspective. It's often easiest for us to identify at the retail level, Lainey. We're a shopping species. Find yourself buying a different brand of frozen peas because the subject does. Watch out. The floor of Lainey's apartment was terraced against the original slope of the parking garage. He slept at the deep end on an inflatable guest bed he'd ordered from the shopping channel. There were no windows. Regulations required a light pump, and reconstituted sunlight sometimes fell from a panel in the ceiling, but he was seldom there during daylight hours. He sat on the slippery edge of the inflatable, picturing Allison Shires in her Fountain Avenue apartment. Larger than this, he knew, but not by much. Windows. Her rent was paid, Slitscan had finally determined, by her married actor. Via a fairly intricate series of blinds, but paid nonetheless. His reptile fund, Kathy called it. He could hold Allison Shire's history in his mind like a single object, like the perfectly detailed scale model of something ordinary, but miraculous, made luminous by the intensity of his focus. He'd never met her or spoken to her, but he'd come to know her, he supposed, in more ways than anyone ever had or would. Husbands didn't know their wives this way, or wives their husbands. Stalkers might aspire to know the objects of their obsession this way, but never could. Until the night he woke after midnight, head throbbing. Too hot. Something wrong with the conditioning again. Florida. The blue shirt he slept in clinging to his back and shoulders. What would she be doing now? Was she staring up awake, at faint bars of reflected light on the ceiling, listening to Upful Group Vine? Kathy suspected he might be cracking up. He looked at his hands. They could be anybody's. He looked at them as though he'd never seen them before. He remembered the 5SB in the orphanage, the taste of it coming while it was still being injected. Rotting metal. The placebo brought no taste at all. He got up. The kitchen corner, sensing him, woke. The fridge door slid aside. A single ancient leaf of lettuce sagged blackly through the plastic rods of one white shelf, a half-empty bottle of Evian on another. He held his cupped hands above the lettuce, willing himself to feel something radiating from its decay, some subtle life force, orgones, particles of an energy unknown to science. Allison Shires was going to kill herself. He knew he'd seen it. Seen it somehow in the incidental data she generated in her mild-mannered passage through the world of things.
Hey there, the fridge said. You've left me open.
Lainey said nothing.
Well, do you want the door open, partner? You know it interferes with the automatic defrost.
Be quiet. His hands felt better, cooler. He stood there until his hands were quite cold, then withdrew them and pressed the tips of his fingers against his temples. The fridge taking this opportunity to close itself without further comment. 20 minutes later, he was on the metro headed for Hollywood, a jacket over his sleep-creased Malaysian Oxford shirt. Isolated figures on station platforms, whipped sideways by perspective in the wind of the trains passing. We're not talking conscious decision here. Blackwell needed what was left of his right ear.
No, Lainey said.
I don't know what I thought I was doing.
You were trying to save her. The girl.
It felt like something snapped. A rubber band. It felt like gravity.
That's what it feels like, Blackwell said.
When you decide.
Somewhere down the hill from the Sunset Metro exit, he passed a man watering his lawn, a rectangle perhaps twice the size of a pool table, illuminated by the medicinal glow of a nearby streetlight. Laney saw the water beading on the perfectly even blades of bright green plastic. The plastic lawn was fenced back from the street with welded steel, upright prison bars supporting bright, untarnished coils of razor wire. The man's house was scarcely larger than his glittering lawn, a survival from a day when the slope to the hills had been covered with bungalows and arbors. There were others like it, tucked between the balconied, carefully varied faces of condos and apartment complexes, tiny properties dating from before the area's incorporation into the city. There was a hint of oranges in the air, but he couldn't see them. The waterer looked up and Laney saw that he was blind, eyes hidden by the black lozenges of video units coupled directly to the optic nerve. You never knew what they were watching. Laney went on, letting whatever drew him set his course through these sleeping streets and the occasional scent of a blooming tree. Distant brakes sounded on Santa Monica. 15 minutes later, he was in front of her building on Fountain Avenue, looking up, fifth floor, 502. The nodal point. You don't want to talk about it? Laney looked up from his empty cup, meeting Blackwell's eyes across the table. I've never really told this to anyone, he said, and it was true. Let's walk, Blackwell said, and stood, his bulk seeming to lift effortlessly, as though he were a helium parade float. Laney wondered what time it might be, here or in L.A. Yamazaki was taking care of the bill. He left Amos and Andes with them, out into a falling mist that wasn't quite rain, the sidewalk a bobbing stream of black umbrellas. Yamazaki produced a black object, no larger than a business card, slightly thicker, and flexed it sharply between his thumbs. A black umbrella flowered. Yamazaki handed it to him. The curve of the black handle felt dry and hollow, and very slightly warm. How do you fold it?
You don't, Yamazaki said. It goes away.
He opened another for himself. Hairless Blackwell, in his micropore, was evidently immune to rain.
Please continue with your account, Mr. Laney.
Through a gap between two distant towers, Laney glimpsed the side of another taller building. He saw vast faces there, vaguely familiar, contorted in inexplicable drama. The non-disclosure agreement Laney had signed was intended to cover any incidences of SlitScan using its connections with DataMerica in ways that might be construed as violations of the law. Such incidences, in Laney's experience, were frequent to the point of being constant, at least at certain advanced levels of research. Since DataMerica had been Laney's previous employer, he hadn't found any of this particularly startling. DataMerica was less a power than a territory. In many ways, it was a law unto itself. Laney's protracted survey of Allison Shires had already involved any number of criminal violations, one of which had provided him with the codes required to open the door into her building's foyer, activate the elevator, unlock the door of her fifth-floor apartment, and cancel the private security alarm that would automatically warrant an armed response if she did these things without keying in two extra digits. This last was intended as insurance against endemic home invasion, a crime in which residents were accosted in parking garages and induced to surrender their codes. Allison Shire's code consisted of her month, date, and year of birth, something any security service strongly advised against. Her backup code was 23, her age the year before, when she'd moved in and become a subscriber. Laney softly reciting these as he stood before her building, its eight-story facade fainting toward someone's idea of Tudor revival. Everything looking so sharply and comprehensively detailed in these first moments of an L.A. dawn. 23. So, Blackwell supposed, you just walked in, punched up a codes, and bang, there you were. The three of them waiting to cross at an intersection.
Bang. No sound at all in the mirrored foyer.
A sense of vacuum. A dozen Laneys reflected there as he crossed an expanse of new carpet, into an elevator smelling of something floral, where he used part of the code again. It took him straight to 5.
The door slid open.
More new carpet. Beneath a fresh coat of cream enamel, the corridor's walls displayed the faint irregularities of old-fashioned plaster.
502.
"What do you think you're doing?" Laney asked aloud, though whether to himself or to Allison Shires he did not, nor would he ever know. The brass round of an antique security fisheye regarded him from the door, partially occluded by a cataract of pale paint. The keypad was set flush with the door's steel frame, not quite level with the fisheye. He watched his finger finding its way through the sequence.
23.
But Allison Shires, naked, opened the door before the code could key. Up full group finds, soaring joyfully behind her as Laney grabbed her blood-slick wrists. And saw there, in her eyes, what he took then and forever as a look of simple recognition. Not even of blame.
"This isn't working," she said,
as though she were indicating a minor appliance. And Laney heard himself whimper, a sound he hadn't made since childhood. He needed to see those wrists, but couldn't, holding her. He was walking her backward toward a wicker armchair he wasn't even aware he'd seen. "Sit," he said, as if to a stubborn child, and she did. He let go of her wrists, ran for where he guessed the bathroom had to be, towels there, and some kind of tape, and discovered himself kneeling beside her where she sat, red fingers curled in toward red palms as if in meditation. He rolled a dark green hand towel around her left wrist and whipped the tape around it, some rubbery beige product meant to mask specific areas during the application of aerosol cosmetics. He knew that from her product purchase data. Were her fingers turning blue beneath their coat of red? He looked up, into that same recognition. One cheekbone brushed with blood.
"Don't," he said.
"It's slowing."
Laney wrapped her right forearm now, the tape roll dangling from his teeth.
"I missed the artery."
"Don't move,"
Laney said, and sprang up, tripping over his own feet, crashing face first into what he recognized just before it broke his nose, as the work of the editor of Lamps. The carpet seemed to whip up and smack him playfully in the face.
"Allison,"
her ankle stepping past him, kitchenward. "Allison, sit down!"
"Sorry,"
he thought he heard her say.
And then the shot.
Blackwell's shoulders heaved as he sighed, making a sound that Laney heard above the traffic. Yamazaki's glasses were filled with jittering pastels. The walls here all neon, a glare to shame Vegas, every surface lit and jumping. Blackwell was staring at Laney. "This way," he said finally, and rounded a corner into relative darkness and an edge of urine. Laney followed, Yamazaki behind him. At the far end of the narrow passage, they emerged into fairyland. No neon here at all. Ambient glow from the towers overhead. Austere rectangles of white frosted glass the size of large greeting cards were daubed with black ideograms, each sign marking a tiny structure like some antique bathing cabin on a forgotten beach. Crowded shoulder to shoulder down one side of the cobbled lane, their miniature facades suggested a shuttered sideshow in some secret urban carnival. Age-silvered cedar, oiled paper, matting. Nothing to pin the place in time, but the fact that the signs were electric. Laney stared. A street built by leprechauns.
"Golden Street," said Keith Allen Blackwell.
Eight.
Narita. Chia deplaned behind Mary Alice, who'd had a couple of those vitamin drinks and then tied up one of the toilets for 20 minutes while she teased her extensions and put on lipstick and mascara. Chia couldn't say much for the result, which looked less like Ashley Modine Carter than something Ashley Modine Carter had slept on. When Chia stood up, she felt like she had to tell her body to do every single thing she needed it to. Legs, move. She'd gotten a few more hours' sleep somewhere back there.
She'd packed her sand fenders back in her bag, and now she was putting one foot in front of the other, as Mary Alice in front of her shuffle-swayed along the narrow aisle in her white cowboy boots. It seemed to take forever to get out of the plane. But then they were breathing airport air in a corridor, under big logos that Chia had known all her life, all those Japanese companies, and everything crowded and moving in one direction.
"You check anything?"
Mary Alice asked beside her.
"No,"
Chia said. Mary Alice let Chia go ahead of her through passport control, where Chia gave the Japanese policeman her passport and the cash flow smart card Zona Rosa had forced Kelsey to come up with, because this was all Kelsey's idea anyway. In theory, the amount in the card represented the bulk of the Seattle chapter's treasury. But Chia suspected Kelsey would wind up footing the bill for the whole thing, and probably wouldn't even care. The policeman pulled her passport out of the counter slot and handed it back to her. He hadn't bothered to check the smart card. 2-week maximum stay, he said, and nodded her on. Frosted glass slid open for her. It was crowded here, way more than SeaTac. So many planes must have come in at once to have all these people waiting for their luggage. She edged aside to let a little robot stacked with suitcases pass. It had dirty pink rubber tires and big cartoon eyes that rolled morosely as it made its way through the crowd.
"Now, that was easy,"
said Mary Alice behind her. Chia turned in time to see her take a long, deep breath, hold it, and let it out. Mary Alice's eyes looked pinched, like she was having a headache.
"Do you know which way I should go to get the train?" she asked.
She had maps in her sand fenders, but she didn't want to have to get it out now.
"This way,"
Mary Alice said. Mary Alice worked her way between people, Chia following with her bag under her arm, emerging in front of a carousel where bags were sliding down a ramp, bumping, swinging past and away.
"Here's one,"
Mary Alice said, snagging a black one and sounding so forcefully cheerful that it made Chia look at her.
"And two."
Another one like it, except this one had a sticker on the side from Nissan County, the third largest gated attraction in the Californias.
"Would you mind carrying this for me, honey? My back goes out on a long plane ride."
Passing Chia the bag with the sticker. It wasn't too heavy, like maybe it was only half full of clothes, but it was too large for her. She had to lean over in the opposite direction to keep it off the ground.
"Thanks,"
Mary Alice said.
"Here."
And she handed Chia a crumpled square of sticky-backed paper with a barcode on it.
"That's the check. Now, we just want to go this way."
It was even harder getting through the crowd, lugging Mary Alice's bag. Chia had to concentrate on not stepping on people's feet and not bumping them too hard with the bag. And the next thing she knew, she'd lost Mary Alice. She looked around, expecting to see hair extensions bobbing above the crowd, who were mostly shorter than Mary Alice. But Mary Alice was nowhere in sight. All arriving passengers must exit through customs. Chia watched the sign twist itself up into Japanese letters, then pop back out as English. Well, that was the way to go. She got in line behind a man in a red leather jacket that said Concept Collision across the back in gray chenille letters. Chia stared at that, imagining concepts colliding, which she guessed was a concept in itself. But then she thought it was probably just the name of a company that fixed cars, or one of those slogans the Japanese made up in English, the ones that almost seemed to mean something, but didn't. This trans-Pacific jet lag thing was serious. Next. They were feeding Concept Collision's suitcase through a machine the size of a double bed, but taller. There was an official of some kind in a video helmet, evidently reading feed off the scanners, and another policeman to take your passport, slot it in the machine, then put your bags through. Chia let him take Mary Alice's suitcase and flip it up onto the conveyor. Chia handed him her carry-on.
"There's a computer in there. This scan okay for that?"
He didn't seem to hear her. She watched her carry-on follow Mary Alice's bag into the machine. The man in the helmet, eyes hidden, was bobbing his head from side to side as he accessed gaze-activated menus. "Baggage check," the policeman said. And Chia remembered she had it in her hand. It struck her as strange, handing it over, that Mary Alice had thought to give her that. The policeman ran a hand scanner over it.
"You packed these bags yourself?" asked the man in the helmet.
He couldn't see her directly, but she assumed he could see the clip stored in her passport, and he could probably see her on live feed as well. Airports were full of cameras.
"Yes," Shia said, deciding it was easier than trying to explain that it was Mary Alice's bag, not hers.
She tried to read the expression on the helmeted man's lips, but it was hard to say if he even had one.
"You packed this?"
"Yes,"
Shia said, not sounding nearly as certain this time. The helmet bobbed.
"Next," he said.
Chia went to the other end of the machine and collected her bag and the black suitcase. Through another sliding wall of frosted glass. She was in a larger hall beneath a higher ceiling. Bigger ads overhead, but no thinning of the crowd. Maybe this wasn't so much a matter of crowds as it was of Tokyo, maybe of Japan in general. More people, closer together. More of those robot baggage carts. She wondered what it cost to rent one. You could lie down on top of your luggage, maybe, tell it where you wanted to go, and then just go to sleep. Except, she wasn't sure she felt sleepy, exactly. She transferred Mary Alice's bag from her left to her right hand, wondering what to do with it if she didn't find Mary Alice inside the next, say, 5 minutes. She'd had enough of airports and the space between them, and she wasn't even sure where she was supposed to sleep tonight. Or if it was night, even. She was looking up, hoping to find some kind of time display, when a hand closed around her right wrist. She looked down at the hand, saw gold rings and a watch to match. Fat links of a gold bracelet. The rings connected to the watch with little gold chains.
"That's my suitcase."
Chia's eyes followed the hand's wrist to a length of bright white cuff, then up the arm of a black jacket. To pale eyes and a long face, each cheek seamed vertically, as if with a modeling instrument. For a second, she took him for her music master, loose somehow in this airport. But her music master would never wear a watch like that. And this one's hair, a darker blonde, was swept back, long and wet-looking from his high forehead. He didn't look happy.
"Mary Alice's suitcase," Chia said.
"She gave it to you? In Seattle?"
"She asked me to carry it."
"From Seattle?"
"No," Chia said. "Back there. She sat beside me on the plane."
"Where is she?"
"I don't know," Chia said.
He wore a black, long-coated suit buttoned high. Like something from an old movie, but new and expensive-looking. He seemed to notice that he was still holding her wrist. Now he let it go.
"I'll carry it for you," he said. "We'll find her." Chia didn't know what to do.
"Mary Alice wanted me to carry it."
"You did. Now I'll carry it." He took it from her.
"Are you Mary Alice's boyfriend, Eddie?"
The corner of his mouth twitched.
"You could say that," he said.
Eddie's car was a Daihatsu Graceland, with the steering wheel on the wrong side. Chia knew that because Rez had ridden in the back of one in a video, except that that one had had a bath in it, black marble, big gold faucets, shaped like tropical fish. People had posted that that was an ironic take on money, on the really ugly things you could do with it if you had too much. Chia had told her mother about that. Her mother said there wasn't much point in worrying what you might do if you had too much, because most people never even had enough. She said it was better to try to figure out what enough actually meant. But Eddie had one, a Graceland, all black and chrome. From the outside, it looked sort of like a cross between an RV and one of those long wedge-shaped Hummer limousines. Chia couldn't imagine there'd be much of a Japanese market. The cars here all looked like little candy-colored lozenges. The Graceland was meshback, pure and simple, designed to sell to the kind of American who made a point of trying not to buy imports. Which, when it came to cars, definitely narrowed your options. Hester Chen's mother had one of those really ugly Canadian trucks that cost a fortune, but were guaranteed to last for 85 years. That was supposed to be better for the ecology.
Inside, the Graceland was all burgundy velour, puffed up in diamonds with little chrome nubs where the points of the diamonds met. It was about the tackiest thing Chia had ever seen, and she guessed Mary Alice thought so too, because Mary Alice, seated next to her, was explaining that it was an image thing, that Eddie had this very hot, very popular country music club called Whiskey Clone, so he'd gotten the Graceland to go with that, and he'd also started dressing the way they did in Nashville. Mary Alice thought that look suited him, she said. Chia nodded. Eddie was driving, talking in Japanese on a speakerphone. They'd found Mary Alice at a tiny little bar just off the arrivals area. It was the third one they'd looked in. Chia got the feeling that Eddie wasn't very happy to see Mary Alice, but Mary Alice hadn't seemed to care. It was Mary Alice's idea that they give Chia a ride into Tokyo. She said the train was too crowded, and it cost a lot anyway. She said she wanted to do Chia a favor because Chia had carried her bag for her. Chia had noticed that Eddie had put one bag in the Graceland's trunk, but kept the one with the Nissan County sticker up front next to him beside the driver's seat. Chia wasn't really listening to Mary Alice now. It was sometime at night, and the jet lag was too weird, and they were on this big bridge that seemed to be made out of neon, with however many lanes of traffic around them, the little cars like strings of bright beads, all of them shiny and new. There were screens that kept blurring past, tall and narrow, with Japanese writing jumping around on some of them, and people on others, faces, smiling as they sold something. And then a woman's face. Rei Towei, the Idaru Rez wanted to marry. And gone. Nine. Out of control. Rice Daniels, Mr. Laney. Out of control. Pressing a card of some kind to the opposite side of the scratched plastic that walled the room called visitors away from those who gave it its name. Laney had tried to read it, but the attempt at focusing had driven an atrocious spike of pain between his eyes. He'd looked at Rice Daniels instead, through tears of pain. Close-cropped dark hair, close-fitting sunglasses with small oval lenses, the black frames gripping the man's head like some kind of surgical clamp. Nothing at all about Rice Daniels appeared to be out of control. The series, he said. Out of control, as in, aren't the media. Out of control, the cutting edge of counter-investigative journalism. Laney had gingerly tried touching the tape across the bridge of his nose. A mistake.
Counter-investigative?
You're a quant, Mr. Laney. A quantitative analyst. He wasn't really, but that was technically his job description. For a slit scan. Laney didn't respond. The girl was the focus of intensive surveillance. Slit scan was all over her. You know why. We believe a case can be made here for slit scan's culpability in the death of Allison Shires.
Laney looked down at his running shoes, their laces removed by the deputies. She killed herself, he said.
But we know why.
No, Laney said,
meeting the black ovals again.
I don't. Not exactly.
The nodal point. Protocols of some other realm entirely. You're going to need help, Laney. You might be looking at a manslaughter charge, abetting a suicide. They'll want to know why you were up there.
I'll tell them why.
Our producers managed to get me in here first, Laney. It wasn't easy. There's a spin control team from Slit Scan out there now waiting to talk with you. If you let them, they'll turn it all around. They'll get you off because they have to in order to cover the show. They can do it, with enough money and the right lawyers. But ask yourself this. Do you want to let them do it?
Daniel still had his business card thumbed up against the plastic. Trying to focus on it again, Laney saw that someone had scratched something in from the other side, in small, uneven mirror letters, so that he could read it left to right.
I-N-O-U-D-I-D-I-T.
I've never heard of out of control.
Our hour-long pilot is in production as we speak, Mr. Laney.
A measured pause.
We're all very excited.
Why?
Out of control isn't just a series. We think of it as an entirely new paradigm, a new way to do television. Your story, Allison Shire's story, is precisely what we intend to get out there. Our producers are people who want to give something back to the audience. They've done well, they're established, they've proven themselves,
Now they want to give something back, to restore a degree of honesty, a new opportunity for perspective.
The black ovals drew slightly closer to the scratched plastic.
Our producers are the producers of Cops in Trouble and A Calm and Deliberate Fashion.
A what?
Factual accounts of premeditated violence in the global fashion industry.
Counter-investigative? Yamazaki's pen hovered over the notebook. It was a show about shows like Slit Scan, Laney explained. Supposed abuses.
There were no stools at the bar, which might have been 10 feet long. You stood. Aside from the bartender in some kind of kabuki drag, they had the place to themselves. By virtue of filling it, basically, it was probably the smallest freestanding commercial structure Laney had ever seen. And it seemed to have been there forever, like a survival from ancient Edo. A city of shadows and minute dark lanes. The walls were shingled with faded postcards, gone a uniform sepia under a glaze of accumulated nicotine and cooking smoke.
Ah, Yamazaki said at last.
A meta-tabloid.
The bartender was broiling 2 sardines on a doll's hot plate. He flipped them with a pair of steel chopsticks, transferred them to a tiny plate, garnished them with some kind of colorless, translucent pickle, and presented them to Laney.
Thanks, Laney said.
The bartender ducked his shaven eyebrows. In spite of the modest decor, there were dozens of bottles of expensive-looking whiskey arranged behind the bar, each one with a handwritten brown paper sticker, the owner's name in Japanese. Yamazaki had explained that you bought one, and they kept it there for you. Blackwell was on his second tumbler of the local vodka analog on the rocks. Yamazaki was sticking to Coke Light. Laney had an untouched shot of surrealistically expensive Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey in front of him, and wondered vaguely what it would do to his jet lag if he were actually to drink it.
So, Blackwell said, draining the tumbler, ice clinking against his prosthetic, they get you out so they can have a go at these other bastards.
That was it, basically, Laney said. They had their own legal team waiting to do that and another team to work on the non-disclosure agreement I'd signed with Slit Scan.
And the second team had the bigger job, Blackwell said, shoving his empty glass toward the bartender, who swept it smoothly out of sight, producing a fresh replacement just as smoothly as if from nowhere.
That's true, Laney said.
He'd had no idea, really, of what he'd be getting into when he'd found himself agreeing to the general outlines of Rice Daniels' offer. But there was something in him that didn't want to see Slit Scan walk away from the sound of that one single shot from Allison Shire's kitchen. Produced, the cops had pointed out, by a Russian-made device, it was hardly more than a cartridge, a tube to contain it, and the simplest possible firing mechanism. These were designed with suicide almost exclusively in mind. There was no way to aim them at anything more than 2 inches away. Laney had heard of them, but had never seen one before. For some reason, they were called Wednesday Night Specials. And Slit Scan would walk away, he knew. They'd drop the sequence on Allison's actor if they felt they had to, and the whole thing would settle to the seafloor, silting over almost instantly with the world's steady accretion of data. And Allison Shire's life as he'd known it in all that terrible, banal intimacy would lie there forever, forgotten, and finally unknowable. But if he went with out of control, her life might retrospectively become something else, and he wasn't sure exactly, sitting there on the hard little chair in Visitors, what that might be. He thought of coral, of the reefs that grew around sunken aircraft carriers. Perhaps she'd become something like that, the buried mystery beneath some exfoliating superstructure of supposition, or even of myth. It seemed to him and Visitors that that might be a slightly less dead way of being dead, and he wished her that. Get me out of here, he said to Daniels, who smiled beneath his surgical clamp, whipping the card triumphantly away from the plastic.
Steady, said Blackwell, laying his huge hand with its silvery pink fretwork of scars over Laney's wrist.
You haven't even had your drink yet.
Laney had met Rydell when the out-of-control team installed him in a suite at the chateau, that ancient simulacrum of a still more ancient original,
its quaint concrete eccentricities pinched between the twin brutalities of a particularly nasty pair of office buildings dating from the final year of the previous century. These reflected all the millennial anxiety of the year of their creation, while refracting it through some other more mysterious, weirdly muted hysteria that seemed somehow more personal and even less attractive. Laney's suite, much larger than his apartment in Santa Monica, was like an elongated 1920s apartment following the long, shallow concrete balcony that faced sunset. This, in turn, overlooking a deeper balcony on the floor below, and the tiny circular lawn that was all that remained of the original gardens. Laney thought it was a strange choice, considering his situation. He would have imagined they'd choose something more corporate, more fortified, more heavily wired. But Rice Daniels had explained that the chateau had advantages all its own. It was a good choice in terms of image, because it humanized Laney. It looked like a habitation, basically. Something with walls and doors and windows, in which a guest could be imagined to be living something akin to a life. Not at all the case with the geometric solids that were serious business hotels. It also had deeply rooted associations with the Hollywood star system, and with human tragedy as well. Stars had lived here in the heyday of old Hollywood, and later certain stars had died here. Out of Control planned to frame the death of Alison Shires as a tragedy in a venerable Hollywood tradition, but one that had been brought on by Slitscan, a very contemporary entity. Besides, Daniels explained, the chateau was far more secure than it might at first look. And at this point, Laney had been introduced to Barry Rydell, the night security man. Daniels and Rydell, it seemed to Laney, had known one another prior to Rydell working at the chateau, though how exactly remained unclear. Rydell seemed oddly at home with the workings of the infotainment industry, and at one point when they'd found themselves alone together, he'd asked Laney who was representing him.
"How do you mean?" Laney had said. "You've got an agent, don't you?"
Laney said he didn't.
"You better get one," Rydell had said.
"Not that it'll necessarily come out the way you'd want it, but hey, it's show business, right?"
It was indeed show business, to an extent that very quickly made Laney wonder if he'd made the right decision. There had been 16 people in his suite for a 4-hour meeting, and he'd only been out of the lockup for 6 hours. When they'd finally gone, Laney had staggered the length of the place, mistakenly trying several closet doors in his search for the bedroom. Finding it, he'd crawled onto the bed and fallen asleep in the clothes they'd sent Rydell to the Beverly Center to buy for him, which he thought he might well do right here, now, in this Golden Street bar, thereby answering the question of what the bourbon was doing to his jet lag. But now, finishing the remainder of the shot, he felt one of those tidal reversals begin, perhaps less to do with the drink than with some inbuilt chemistry of fatigue and displacement. "Was Rydell happy?" Yamazaki asked. It seemed a strange question to Laney, but then he'd remembered Rydell mentioning someone Japanese, someone he'd known in San Francisco. And that, of course, had been Yamazaki.
"Well," Laney said, "he didn't strike me as desperately unhappy. But there was something sort of down about him. You could say that. I mean, I don't really know him well at all."
"It is too bad," Yamazaki said. "Rydell is a brave man."
"How about you, Laney?" Blackwell said. "You think of yourself as a brave man?"
The worm-like scar that bisected his eyebrow writhed into a new degree of concentration.
"No," Laney said. "I don't."
"But you went up against Slitscan, didn't you? Because of what they did to the girl? You had a job, you had food, you had a place to sleep. You got all that from Slitscan, but they did the girl, so you opted to do him back. Is that right?"
"Nothing's ever that simple," Laney said.
When Blackwell spoke, Laney was unexpectedly aware of another sort of intelligence, something the man must ordinarily conceal.
"No," Blackwell said, almost gently. "It fucking well isn't, is it?"
One large, pinkly jigsawed hand, like some clumsy animal in its own right, began to root in the taut breast pocket of Blackwell's micropore, producing a small gray metallic object that he placed on the bar.
Now, that's a nail, Blackwell said. Galvanized, 1.5-inch roofing. I've nailed men's hands to bars like this, with nails like that. And some of them were right bastards.
There was nothing at all of threat in Blackwell's voice.
And some of those you nail their one end, their other comes up with a razor or a pair of needle-nose pliers.
Blackwell's forefinger absently found an angry-looking scar beneath his right eye, as though something had entered there and been deflected along the cheekbone.
To have a go, right?
Pliers.
Bastard, Blackwell said. You have to kill him, then. Now, that's one kind of brave, Laney. What I mean is, how's that so different from what you tried to do at Slitscan?
I just didn't want them to let it drop. To let her settle to the bottom, be forgotten. I didn't really care how badly Slitscan got hurt, or even if they were damaged or not. I wasn't thinking of revenge as much as of a way of keeping her alive.
There's other men. You nail their hand to a table. They'll sit there and look at you. That's your true hard man, Laney.
Do you think you're one of those? Laney looked from Blackwell to the empty bourbon glass, back to Blackwell. The bartender moved as if to refill it, but Laney covered it with his hand. If you nail my hand to the bar, Blackwell.
And here he spread his other hand flat, palm down on the dark wood, the drink-ringed varnish.
I'll scream, okay? I don't know what any of this is about. You might be crazy, but what I most definitely am not is anybody's idea of a hero. I'm not now, and I wasn't back there in L.A.
Blackwell and Yamazaki exchanged glances. Blackwell pursed his lips, gave a tiny nod. Good on you, then, he said. I think you just might be right for the job.
No job, Laney said.
But let the bartender pour him a second bourbon.
I don't want to hear about any job at all. Not until I know who's hiring me.
I'm chief of security for Low Res, Blackwell said. And I owe that silly bastard my life. The last five of which I'd have passed in the punitive bowels of the state of fucking Victoria, if it hadn't been for him. Though I'd have taught myself first, no fear.
The band? Your security for them?
Rydell spoke well of you, Mr. Laney.
Yamazaki's neck bobbed in the collar of his plaid shirt. I don't know Rydell, Laney said. He was just the night watchman at a hotel I couldn't afford.
Rydell has a good sense of people, I think, Yamazaki said.
To Blackwell. Low Res. They're in trouble.
Res, Blackwell said. He says he's going to marry this Jap. Twist doesn't fucking exist. And he knows she doesn't. And says we've no fucking imagination.
Now hear me. And Blackwell produced, from some unspecific region of his clothing, a mirror-polished rectangle with a round hole through its uppermost leading corner. Something not much larger than a cash card, to see it in his big hand.
Someone's got to our boy. Hear? Got to him. Don't know how, don't know who, though personally myself, I'd bet on the fucking combinat, those rust bastards. But you, my friend, you're going to do your nodal thing for us on our res, and you are going to find fucking out. Who?
And the rectangle came down with a concise little thunk, to be left standing crosswise to the counter's grain.
And Laney saw that it was a very small meat cleaver, with round steel rivets through its tidy rosewood handle. And when you do, Blackwell said, we shall salt them well and fucking out.
10. Whiskey Clone.
Eddie's club was way up in something like an office building. She didn't think there were music clubs on the upper floors of buildings like that in Seattle, but she wasn't sure. She'd fallen asleep in the Graceland, and only woke up as Eddie was driving into a garage entrance, and then up into something vaguely like a Ferris wheel, or the cylinder of an old-fashioned revolver, except the bullets were cars. She watched out the windows as it swung them up and over to stop at the top, where Eddie drove forward into a parking garage that might have been anywhere, except the cars were all big and black, though none as big as the Graceland.
Come on up with us and freshen up, honey, Mary Alice said. You look wrecked. I have to port, Chia said. Find my friend I'm staying with.
Easy enough,
Mary Alice said, sliding across the velour and opening the door. Eddie got out the driver's side, taking the bag with the Nissan County sticker with him. He still didn't look very happy. Chia took her bag with her and followed Mary Alice. They all got into an elevator. Eddie pressed his palm against a hand-shaped outline on the wall and said something in Japanese. The elevator said something back. Then the door closed and they were going up. Fast, it felt like. But they just kept going. Being in the elevator didn't seem to be improving Eddie's mood. He had to stand right up close to Mary Alice, and Chia could see a little muscle working in the hinge of his jaw as he looked at her. Mary Alice just looked right back at him.
You ought to lighten up, Mary Alice said. It's done.
The little muscle went into overdrive.
That was not the deal, he said finally. That was not the arrangement.
Mary Alice lifted an eyebrow.
You used to appreciate a little innovation.
Eddie glanced from Mary Alice to Chia, then quick back to Mary Alice.
You call that an innovation?
You used to have a sense of humor, too,
Mary Alice said, as the elevator stopped and the door slid open. Eddie glared, then stepped out, Chia and Mary Alice following.
Never mind him,
Mary Alice said.
Just how he gets sometimes.
Chia wasn't sure what she'd expected, but this definitely wasn't it. A messy room jammed with shipping cartons and a bank of security monitors. The low ceiling was made of those fibery tiles that were hung on little metal rails. About half of them were missing, with wires and cables looping down from dusty-looking shadow. There were a couple of small desk lamps, one of them illuminating a stack of used instant noodle containers and a black coffee mug filled with white plastic spoons. A Japanese man in a black mesh back that said Whiskey Clone across the front was sitting in a swivel chair in front of the monitors, pouring himself a hot drink out of a big thermos with pink flowers on the side.
Yo, Calvin,
Mary Alice said. Or that was what it sounded like. Hey, the man said.
Calvin from Tacoma,
Mary Alice said, as Chia watched Eddie, still carrying the suitcase, march straight through the room, through a door, and out of sight.
Boss looks happy, the man said,
sounding no more Japanese than Mary Alice. He took a sip from his thermos cup.
Yeah,
Mary Alice said.
He's so glad to see me, he's beside himself.
This too will pass.
Another sip, looking at Chia from beneath the bill of the mesh back. The letters in Whiskey Clone were the kind they'd use in a mall when they wanted you to think a place was traditional.
This is Chia,
Mary Alice said.
Met her in SeaTac.
And Chia noticed that she hadn't said she'd met her on the plane, which made her remember that business with the DNA sampling and the hair extensions.
Glad to hear it's still there, the man said.
Means there's some way back out of this batshit.
Now, Calvin,
Mary Alice said,
you know you love Tokyo?
Sure. Had a place in Redmond, had a bathroom the size of the whole apartment I got here, and it wasn't even a big bathroom. I mean, it had a shower, no tub or anything. Chia looked at the screens behind him. Lots of people there, but she couldn't tell what they were doing.
Looks like a good night,
Mary Alice said, surveying the screen. Just fair, he said. Fair to middling.
Quit talking like that, Mary Alice said. You'll have me doing it.
Calvin grinned. But you're a good old girl, aren't you, Mary Alice?
Please,
Chia said.
May I use a data port? There's one in Eddie's office,
Mary Alice said.
But he's probably on the phone now. Why don't you go in the washroom there,
indicating another door, closed,
and have a wash. You're looking a little blurry. Then Eddie'll be done and you can call your friend.
The washroom had an old steel sink and a very new, very complicated looking toilet with at least a dozen buttons on top of the tank. These were labeled in Japanese. The polymer seat squirmed slightly, taking her weight, and she almost jumped up again. It's okay, she reassured herself. Just foreign technology. When she was done, she chose one of the controls at random, producing a superfine spray of warm, perfumed water that made her gasp and jump back. She She wiped her eyes with the back of her hand, then stood well to the side and tried another button. This one seemed to do the trick. The toilet flushed with a jet stream sound that reminded her of being on the plane. As she washed her hands and then her face at the reassuringly ordinary sink, using pale blue liquid soap from a pump-top dispenser shaped like a one-eyed dinosaur, she heard the flushing stop and another sound begin. She looked back and saw a ring of purplish light oscillating somewhere below the toilet seat. UV, she supposed, sterilizing it. There was a poster of the Dukes of Nukem taped on the wall, this hideous roid-head metal band. They were sweaty and blank-eyed, grinning, and the drummer was missing his front teeth. The lettering was in Japanese. She wondered why anyone in Japan would be into that, because groups like the Dukes were all about hating anything that wasn't their idea of American. But Kelsey, who'd been to Japan lots with her father, had said that she couldn't tell what the Japanese would make of anything. There wasn't anything here to dry your hands on. She got a t-shirt out of her bag and used that, although it didn't work very well. As she was kneeling to stuff the shirt back in, she noticed a corner of something she didn't recognize. But then Calvin cracked the door behind her. "Excuse me," he said.
"It's okay,"
Chia said, zipping the bag shut. "It's not," he said, looking back over his shoulder, then back at her. "You really meet Mary Alice at SeaTac?"
"On the plane," Chia said.
"You're not part of it?" Chia stood up, which made her feel kind of dizzy.
"Part of what?"
He looked at her from beneath the brim of the black cap. "Then you really ought to get out of here. I mean, right now."
"Why?"
she asked, although it didn't strike her as a bad idea at all. "Nothing you want to know anything about." There was a crash somewhere behind him. He winced. "It's okay. She's just throwing things. They haven't gotten serious yet. Come on." And he grabbed her bag by the shoulder strap and lifted it up. He was moving fast now, and she had to hustle to keep up with him. Out past the closed door of Eddie's office, past the bank of screens, where she thought she saw people line dancing in cowboy hats, she was never sure. Calvin slapped his hand on the sensor plate on the elevator door. "Take you to the garage," he said, as the sound of breaking glass came from Eddie's office. "Hang a left, about 20 feet, there's another elevator. Skip the lobby, we got cameras there. Bottom button gets you the subway. Get on a train." He passed her her bag.
"Which one?"
she asked. Mary Alice screamed, like something really, really hurt. "Doesn't matter," Calvin said, and quickly said something in Japanese to the elevator. The elevator answered, but he was already gone, the door closing, and then she was descending, her bag seeming to lighten slightly in her arms. Eddie's Graceland was still there when the door slid open, a hulking wedge beside those other black cars. She found the second elevator Calvin had told her to take, its door scratched and dented. It had regular buttons, and it didn't talk, and it took her down to malls bright as day, crowds moving through them, to escalators and platforms and maglevs, and the eternal logos tethered overhead. She was in Tokyo at last. 11. Collapse of New Buildings. Lainey's room was high up in a narrow tower faced with white ceramic tile. It was trapezoidal in cross-section and dated from the 80s boom town, the years of the bubble. That it had survived the great earthquake was testimony to the skill of its engineers. That it had survived the subsequent reconstruction testified to an arcane tangle of ownership and an ongoing struggle between two of the city's oldest criminal organizations. Yamazaki had explained this in the cab returning from New Golden Street.
"We were uncertain how you might feel about new buildings," he'd said.
"You mean the nanotech buildings?" Lainey had been struggling to keep his eyes open. The driver wore spotless white gloves.
"Yes, some people find them disturbing."
"I don't know. I'd have to see one."
"You can see them from your hotel, I think."
And he could. He knew their sheer brutality of scale from construct. But virtuality had failed to convey the peculiarity of their apparent texture, a streamlined organicism.
"They are like Giger's paintings of New York," Yamazaki had said.
But the reference had been lost on Lainey. Now he sat on the edge of his bed, staring blankly out at these miracles of the new technology, as banal and as sinister as such miracles usually were, and they were only annoying. The world's largest inhabited structures, the Chernobyl containment structure, was larger, but nothing human would ever live there. The umbrella Yamazaki had given him was collapsing into itself, shrinking, going away. The phone began to ring. He couldn't find it. "Telephone," he said. "Where is it?" A nub of ruby light timed to the rings began to pulse from a flat rectangle of white cedar arranged on a square black tray on a bedside ledge. He picked it up, thumbed a tiny square of mother-of-pearl. "Hey," someone said. "That Laney?" "Who's calling?" "Rydell from the chateau. Hans, let me use the phone." Hans was the night manager. "I get the time right. You having breakfast?" Laney rubbed his eyes, looked out again at the new buildings. "Sure." "I called Yamazaki," Rydell said. "Got your number."
"Thanks," Laney said, yawning. "But I..."
"Yamazaki said you got the gig."
"I think so," Laney said.
"Thanks."
"Guess I owe..."
"Slit scan," Rydell said. "All over the chateau."
"No," Laney said. "That's over."
"You know any Catherine Torrance, Laney? Sherman Oaks address? She's up in the suite you had with about 2 vans worth of sensing gear. Hans figures you're trying to get a read on what you're doing up there. Any dope or anything?" Laney stared out at the towers. Part of a facade seemed to move, but it had to be his eyes. "But Hans says there's no way they can sort the residual molecules out in those rooms anyway. Place has too much of a history."
"Kathy Torrance? From Slitscan?"
"Not like they said they were, but they've got all these techs, and techs always talk too much. And Jengus down in the garage saw the decals on some of the cases when they were unloading. There's about 20 of them, if you don't count the gophers. Got 2 suites and 4 singles. Don't tip."
"But what are they doing?"
"That sensor stuff. Trying to figure out what you got up to in the suite. And one of the bellmen saw them setting up a camera." The entire facade of one of the new buildings seemed to ripple, to crawl slightly. Laney closed his eyes and pinched the bridge of his nose, discovering a faint trace of pain residing there from the break. He opened his eyes.
"But I never got up to anything."
"Whatever." Rydell sounded slightly hurt.
"I just thought you ought to know is all."
Something was definitely happening to that facade.
"I know. Thanks. Sorry."
"I'll let you know if I hear anything," Rydell said. "What's it like over there, anyway?" Laney was watching a point of reflected light slide across the distant structure, a movement like osmosis or the sequential contraction of some sea creature's palps.
"It's strange."
"Bet it's interesting," Rydell said. "Enjoy your breakfast, okay? I'll keep in touch."
"Thanks," Laney said,
and Rydell hung up. Laney put the phone back on the lacquer tray and stretched out on the bed fully clothed. He closed his eyes, not wanting to see the new buildings. But they were still there in the darkness and the light behind his lid. And as he watched, they slid apart, deliquesced, and trickled away, down into the mazes of an older city. He slid down with them. 12. Mitsuko. Chia used a public data port in the deepest level of the station. The sandbenders sent the number they'd given her for Mitsuko Mimura, the Tokyo chapter's social secretary. Everyone in Tokyo chapter seemed to have a formal title. A girl's sleepy voice in Japanese from the sandbender speakers. The translation followed instantly.
"Hello? Yes? May I help you?
It's Chia McKenzie from Seattle."
"You are still in Seattle?"
"I'm here, in Tokyo."
She upped the scale on the sandbender's map.
"In a subway station called Shinjuku."
"Yes, very good. Are you coming here now?"
"I'd sure like to. I'm really tired."
The voice began to explain the route.
It's okay, Chia said. My computer can do it. Just tell me the station I have to get to.
She found it on the map, set a marker.
How long will it take to get there? 20 to 30 minutes, depending on how crowded the trains are. I will meet you there. You don't have to do that, Chia said. Just give me your address. Japanese addresses are difficult. It's okay, Chia said. I've got global positioning.
The sandbenders working the Tokyo Telco was already showing her Mitsuko Mimura's latitude and longitude. In Seattle, that only worked for business numbers.
No, Mitsuko said. I must greet you. I am the social secretary. Thanks, Chia said. I'm on my way.
With her bag over her shoulder, left partly unzipped so she could follow the sandbender's verbal prompts, Chia rode an escalator up 2 levels, bought a ticket with her cash card, and found her platform. It was really crowded as the airport. But when the train came, she let the crowd pick her up and squash her into the nearest car. It would have been harder not to get on. As they pulled out, she heard the sandbenders announce that they were leaving Shinjuku Station. The sky was like mother of pearl when Chia emerged from the station. Gray buildings, pastel neon, a streetscape dotted with vaguely unfamiliar shapes. Dozens of bicycles were parked everywhere, the fragile-looking kind with paper tube frames spun with carbon fiber. Chia took a step back as an enormous turquoise garbage truck rumbled past, its driver's white-gloved hands visible on the high wheel. As it cleared her field of vision, she saw a Japanese girl wearing a short plaid skirt and black biker jacket. The girl smiled. Chia waved. Mitsuko's second-floor room was above the rear of her father's restaurant. Chia could hear a steady thumping sound from below, and Mitsuko explained that that was a food prep robot that chopped and sliced things. The room was smaller than Chia's bedroom in Seattle, but much cleaner, very neat and organized. So was Mitsuko, who had a razor-edged coppery diagonal bleached into her black bangs and wore sneakers with double soles. She was 13, a year younger than Chia. Mitsuko had introduced Chia to her father, who wore a white short-sleeve shirt, a tie, and was supervising 3 white-gloved men in blue coveralls who were cleaning his restaurant with great energy and determination. Mitsuko's father had nodded, smiled, said something in Japanese, and gone back to what he was doing. On their way upstairs, Mitsuko, who didn't speak much English, told Chia that she told her father that Chia was part of some cultural exchange program, short-term homestay, something to do with her school. Mitsuko had the same poster on her wall, the original cover shot from the Dog Soup album. Mitsuko went downstairs, returning with a pot of tea and a covered segmented box that contained a California roll and an assortment of less familiar things. Grateful for the familiarity of the California roll, Chia ate everything except the one with the orange sea urchin goo on top. Mitsuko complimented her on her skill with chopsticks. Chia said she was from Seattle and people there used chopsticks a lot. Now they were both wearing wireless ear clip headsets. The translation was generally glitch-free, except when Mitsuko used Japanese slang that was too new, or when she inserted English words that she knew but couldn't pronounce. Chia wanted to ask her about Rez and the Idoru, but they kept getting onto other things. Then Chia fell asleep, sitting up cross-legged on the floor, and Mitsuko must have managed to roll her onto a hard little futon thing that she'd unfolded from somewhere, because that was where Chia woke up 3 hours later. A rainy silver light was at the room's narrow window. Mitsuko appeared with another pot of tea and said something in Japanese. Chia found her ear clip and put it on. You must have been exhausted, the ear clip translated. Then Mitsuko said she was taking the day off from school to be with Chia. They drank the nearly colorless tea from little nubbly ceramic cups. Mitsuko explained that she lived here with her father, her mother, and a brother, Masahiko. Her mother was away visiting a relative in Kyoto. Mitsuko said that Kyoto was very beautiful and that Chia should go there. I'm here for my chapter, Chia said. I can't do tourist things. I have things to find out. I understand, Mitsuko said. So is it true? Does Rez really want to marry a software agent? Mitsuko looked uncomfortable. I am the social secretary, she said.
You must first discuss this with Hiromi Ogawa.
Who's she?
Hiromi is the president of our chapter.
Fine,
Chia said.
When do I talk to her?
We are erecting a site for the discussion. It will be ready soon. Mitsuko still looked uncomfortable. Chia decided to change the subject.
What's your brother like? How old is he?
Masahiko is 17, Mitsuko said. He is a pathological techno-fetishist with social deficit. This last all strung together like one word, indicating a concept that taxed the lexicon of the ear clips. Chia wondered briefly if it would be worth running it through her sandbenders, whose translation functions updated automatically whenever she ported.
A what?
Otaku, Mitsuko said carefully in Japanese. The translation burped its clumsy word string again.
Oh,
Chia said.
We have those. We even use the same word.
I think that in America, they are not the same, Mitsuko said.
Well, Chia said, it's a boy thing, right? The otaku guys at my last school were into, like, plastic anime babes, military simulations, and trivia. Big time into trivia.
She watched Mitsuko listen to the translation.
Yes, Mitsuko said. But you say they go to school. Ours do not go to school. They complete their studies online, and that is bad because they cheat easily. Then they are tested later and are caught and fail, but they do not care. It is a social problem.
Your brother's one?
Yes, Mitsuko said. He lives in Walled City.
In where?
A multi-user domain. It is his obsession, like a drug. He has a room here. He seldom leaves it. All his waking hours, he is in Walled City. His dreams, too, I think.
Chia tried to get more of a sense of Hiromi Ogawa before the noon meeting, but with mixed results. She was older, 17, as old as Zona Rosa, and had been in the club for at least 5 years. She was possibly overweight, though this had to be conveyed in intercultural girl code, nothing overt, and favored elaborate iconics. But overall, Chia kept running up against Mitsuko's sense of her duty to her chapter, and of her own position, and of Hiromi's position. Chia hated club politics, and she was beginning to suspect they might pose a real problem here. Mitsuko was getting her computer out. It was one of those soft, transparent Korean units, the kind that looked like a flat bag of clear white jelly with a bunch of colored jujubes inside. Chia unzipped her bag and pulled her sandbenders out.
What is that?
Mitsuko asked.
My computer.
Mitsuko was clearly impressed.
Is it by Harley Davidson?
It was made by the Sandbenders, Chia said, finding her goggles and gloves.
They're a commune down on the Oregon coast. They do these, and they do software.
Is it American?
Sure. I had not known Americans made computers, Mitsuko said.
Chia worked each silver thimble over the tips of her fingers and thumbs, fastened the wrist straps.
I'm ready for the meeting,
she said. Mitsuko giggled nervously. 13. Character recognition. Yamazaki phoned just before noon. The day was dim and overcast. Lainey had closed the curtains in order to avoid seeing the nanotech buildings in that light. He was watching an NHK show about champion top spinners. The star he gathered was a little girl with pigtails and a blue dress with an old-fashioned sailor's collar. She was slightly cross-eyed, perhaps from concentration. The tops were made of wood. Some of them were big and looked heavy.
Hello, Mr. Lainey, Yamazaki said. You are feeling better now?
Lainey watched a purple and yellow top blur into action as the girl gave the carefully wound cord an expert pull. The commentator held a hand mic near the top to pick up the hum it was producing, then said something in Japanese.
Better than last night, Lainey said.
It is being arranged for you to access the data that surrounds our friend. It is a complicated process, as this data has been protected in many different ways. There was no single strategy. The ways in which his privacy has been protected are complexly incremental.
Does our friend know about this?
There was a pause. Lainey watched the spinning top. He imagined Yamazaki blinking.
No, he does not.
I still don't know who I'll really be working for. For him? For Blackwell?
Your employer is Paragon Asia Dataflow Melbourne. They are employing me as well.
What about Blackwell?
Blackwell is employed by a privately held corporation, through which portions of our friend's income pass. In the course of our friend's career, a structure has been erected to optimize that flow to minimize losses. That structure now constitutes a corporate entity in its own right.
Management, Laney said. His management's scared because it looks like he might do something crazy. Is that it? The purple and yellow top was starting to exhibit the first of the oscillations that would eventually bring it to a halt.
I am still a stranger to this business culture, Mr. Laney. I find it difficult to assess these things.
What did Blackwell mean last night about Rez wanting to marry a Japanese girl who isn't real?
Idoru,
Yamazaki said. What?
Idol singer. She is Rei Toei. She is a personality construct. A congeries of software agents, the creation of information designers. She is akin to what I believe they call a synthespian in Hollywood.
Laney closed his eyes, opened them. Then how can he marry her?
I don't know, Yamazaki said. But he has very forcefully declared this to be his intention.
Can you tell me what it is they've hired you to do?
Initially, I think they hoped I would be able to explain the Idoru to them. Her appeal to her audience. Therefore, perhaps her appeal to him. Also, I think that, like Blackwell, they remain unconvinced that this is not the result of a conspiracy of some kind. Now they want me to acquaint you with the cultural background of the situation.
Who are they?
I cannot be more specific now.
The top was starting to wobble.
Laney saw something like terror in the girl's eyes.
You don't think there's a conspiracy?
I will try to answer your questions this evening. In the meantime, while it is being arranged for you to access the data, please study these.
Hey,
Laney protested, as his top-spinning girl was replaced by an unfamiliar logo, a grinning cartoon bulldog with a spiked collar, up to its muscular neck and a big bowl of soup. Two documentary videos on low res, Yamazaki said. These are on the Dog Soup label, originally a small independent based in East Taipei. They released the band's first recording. Low res later purchased Dog Soup and used it to release less commercial material by other artists. Laney stared glumly at the grinning bulldog, missing the girl with pigtails.
Like documentaries about themselves?
The documentaries were not made subject to the band's approval. They are not low-res corporate documents.
Well, I guess we've got that to be thankful for.
You are welcome.
Yamazaki hung up.
The virtual POV zoomed, rotating in on one of the spikes on the dog's collar. In close-up, it was a shining steel pyramid. Reflected clouds whipped past in time-lapse on the towering triangular face as the Universal Copyright Agreement warning scrolled into view. Laney watched long enough to see that the video was spliced together from bits and pieces of the band's public relations footage.
Art warning, he said,
and went into the bathroom to decipher the shower controls. He managed to miss the first 6 minutes, showering and brushing his teeth. He'd seen things like that before, art videos, but he'd never actually tried to pay attention to one. Putting on the hotel's white terry robe, he told himself he'd better try. Yamazaki seemed capable of quizzing him on it later. Why did people make things like this? There was no narration, no apparent structure. Some of the same fragments kept repeating throughout at different speeds. In Los Angeles, there were whole public access channels devoted to things like this, and homemade talk shows hosted by naked Encino witches who sat in front of big paintings of the goddess they'd done in their garages. Except you could watch that. The logic of these cut-ups, he supposed, was that by making one, you could somehow push back at the medium. Maybe it was supposed to be something like treading water, a simple, repetitive human activity that temporarily provided at least an illusion of parity with the sea. But to Laney, who had spent many of his waking hours down in the deeper realms of data that underlay the worlds of media, it only looked hopeless. And tedious, too. Although he supposed that that boredom was somehow meant to be harnessed here. Another way of pushing back. Why else would anyone have selected and edited all these bits of low and res,
the Chinese guitarist and the half-Irish singer, saying stupid things in dozens of different television spots, most of them probably intended for translation. Greetings seem to be a theme. We're happy to be here in Vladivostok. We hear you've got a great new aquarium. We congratulate you on your free elections and your successful dengue abatement campaign. We've always loved London. New York, you're pragmatic.
Laney explored the remains of his breakfast, finding a half-eaten slice of cold brown toast under a steel plate cover. There was an inch of coffee left in the pot. He didn't want to think about the call from Rydell or what it might mean. He thought he was done with Slitscan, done with the lawyers.
"Singapore, you're beautiful," Rez said, Lo chiming in with, "Hello, Lion City."
He picked up the remote and hopefully tried the fast forward. No.
Mute?
No. Yamazaki was having this stuff piped in for his benefit. He considered unplugging the console, but he was afraid they'd be able to tell. It was speeding up now. The cuts more frequent, the whole more content-free, a numbing blur. Rez's grin was starting to look sinister, something with an agenda of its own that jumped unchanged from one cut to the next. Suddenly it all slid away, into handheld shadow, highlights on rococo gilt. There was a clatter of glassware. The image had a peculiar flattened quality that he knew from Slitscan. The smallest lapel cameras did that, the ones disguised as flecks of lint. A restaurant? Club? Someone seated opposite the camera, beyond a phalanx of green bottles. The darkness and the bandwidth of the tiny camera making the features impossible to read. Then Rez leaned forward, recognizable in the new depth of focus. He gestured toward the camera with a glass of red wine. If we could ever once stop talking about the music and the industry and all the politics of that, I think I'd probably tell you that it's easier to desire and pursue the attention of tens of millions of total strangers than it is to accept the love and loyalty of the people closest to us. Someone, a woman, said something in French. Laney guessed that she was the one wearing the camera.
Ease up, Rosa. She doesn't understand half you're saying.
Laney sat forward. The voice had been Blackwell's.
Doesn't she?
Rez receded, out of focus.
Because if she did, I think I'd tell her about the loneliness of being misunderstood. Or is it the loneliness of being afraid to allow ourselves to be understood?
And the frame froze on the singer's blurred face. A date and time stamp.
2 years earlier.
The word misunderstood appeared. The phone rang.
Yeah? Blackwell says there is a window of opportunity. The schedule has been moved up. You can access now.
It was Yamazaki. Good, Laney said. I don't think I'm getting very far with this first video.
Rez's quest for renewed artistic meaning? Don't worry. We will screen it for you again later.
I'm relieved, Laney said. Is the second one as good?
The second documentary is more conventionally structured. In-depth interviews, biographical detail, BBC 3 years ago.
Wonderful.
Blackwell is on his way to the hotel. Goodbye.
Tokyo Chapter. The site Mitsuko's chapter had erected for the meeting reminded Chia of Japanese prints she'd seen on a school trip to the museum in Seattle. There was a brownish light that seemed to arrive through layers of ancient varnish. There were hills in the distance with twisted trees, their branches like quick black squiggles of ink. She came vectoring in beside Mitsuko toward a wooden house with deep overhanging eaves, its shape familiar from anime. It was the sort of house that ninjas crept into in the dark to wake a sleeping heroine and tell her that all was not as she thought, that her uncle was in league with the evil warlord. She checked how she was presenting in a small peripheral window, put a nudge more depth into her lips. Nearing the house, she saw that everything had been worked up out of club archives, so that the whole environment was actually made of low-res material. You noticed it first in the wood and paper panels of the walls,
where faint image fragments, larger than life, came and went with the organic randomness of leaf-dappled sun and shadow. Rez's cheekbone and half a pair of black glasses, Lowe's hand cording the neck of his guitar. But these changed, were replaced with a moth-like flicker, and there would be more, all the way down into the site's finest resolution, its digital fabric. She wasn't sure if you could do that with enough of the right kind of fractal packets, or if you needed some kind of special computer. Her sandbenders managed a few effects like that, but mainly in its presentation of sandbenders software. Screens slid aside as she and Mitsuko, seated cross-legged, entered the house. Coming to a neat halt, side by side, still seated, floating about 3 inches off the tatami, which Chiyo avoided focusing on after she'd seen that it was woven from concert footage, too distracting. It was a nice way to make an entrance. Mitsuko was wearing the kimono and the wide belt thing, the whole traditional outfit, except there was some low-key animation going on in the weave of the fabric. Chiyo herself had downloaded this black Silke Marie Kolb blouson and tight set, even though she hated paying for virtual designer stuff that they wouldn't even let you keep or copy. She'd used Kelsey's cash card number for that, though, which had made her feel better about it. There were 7 girls waiting there, all in kimonos, all floating just off the tatami, except the one sitting by herself at the head of the imaginary table, was a robot. Not like any real robot, but a slender, chrome-skinned thing, like Mercury constrained within the form of a girl. The face was smooth, only partially featured, eyeless, with twin straight rows of small holes where a mouth should have been. That would be Hiromi Ogawa, and Chiyo immediately decided to believe that she was overweight. Hiromi's kimono was crawling with animated sepia-tone footage from band interviews. The introductions took a while, and everyone there definitely had a title, but Chiyo had stopped paying attention after Hiromi's introduction, except to bow when she thought she was supposed to. She didn't like it that Hiromi would turn up that way for a first meeting. It was rude, she thought, and it had to be deliberate. And the trouble they'd gone to with the space just seemed to make it more deliberate. "We are honored to welcome you, Chiyo Mackenzie. Our chapter looks forward to affording you every assistance. We are proud to be a part of the ongoing global appreciation of low-res, their music, and their art." "Thank you," Chiyo said, and sat there as a silence lengthened. Mitsuko quietly cleared her throat. Uh-oh, Chiyo thought. Speech time. "Thank you for offering to help," Chiyo said. "Thanks for your hospitality. If any of you ever comes to Seattle, we'll find a way to put you up. But mainly thanks for your help, because my chapter's been really worried about this story that Rez claims he wants to marry some kind of software agent. And since he's supposed to have said it when he was over here, we thought..." Chiyo had had the feeling that she was moving along a little too abruptly, and this was confirmed by another tiny throat-clearing signal from Mitsuko. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.